Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, President Calvin Coolidge at Mount Dora's Lakeside Inn.
Once they were out of office, they came here to Lakeside Inn, but they did a whole bunch of traveling throughout the state. And I think it was just kind of a way to remove themselves from being in office for so long and do some sightseeing.
We'll discuss St. Augustine in the 17th century.
In 1600, St. Augustine's population was a polyglot mix of Spanish descendant Creoles, Africans, many of whom were enslaved, indigenous people, and shipwrecked survivors from a variety of European nations.
And we'll talk about early flights in Florida. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
We have a special need for a sanctuary like this, to which we can retreat from quarry time, from the daily turmoil, and have a place to rest and think under the quieting influences of nature and nature's God.
Calvin Coolidge was President of the United States from 1923 through 1929. Just 1 month before his presidency ended, Coolidge visited Florida to dedicate the Singing Tower at Bock Tower Gardens in Lake Wales. That same year, he dedicated the 3,500-year-old bald cypress tree in Longwood known as the Senator. That tree burned down in 2012. The Singing Tower at Bock Tower Gardens still has Calvin Coolidge's name carved into it. Madonna Jarvis Wise is a community historian and author.
He was a very good friend of Edward Bock, who was a Pulitzer Prize-winning editor, and they had a lifelong friendship. So he was at the dedication of the Bock Tower in Polk County that's still there and magnificently attended. And I believe there were 50,000 people there.
Calvin Coolidge was elected vice president under Warren G. Harding in 1920. When Harding died in 1923, Coolidge became president of the United States and was reelected in 1924. Coolidge left office as a very popular president, having overseen the economic boom of the Roaring Twenties, although historians are divided about how much his economic policies contributed to the Great Depression of the following decade. 1 month after his dedication of Bock Tower Gardens in 1929, Coolidge was replaced as president by his former Secretary of Commerce, Herbert Hoover. Less than a year later, in January 1930, Coolidge and his wife Grace returned to Florida for their first vacation in many years. Coolidge gave a talk at the New York Life Insurance Conference in the Vinoy Hotel in St. Petersburg. While on the Gulf Coast, Coolidge visited Tarpon Springs on his way to Mount Dora for an extended stay at Lakeside Inn. As Lakeside Inn owner Jim Gunderson explains, in early 1930, Coolidge was greeted warmly in cities and towns around Florida that he visited from his home base in Mount Dora.
Mount Dora became their home, their hub, as it were. But you know, a couple times a week or so, they were definitely going out and about. You know, a lot of support, I think, at the time. You know, for President Coolidge and what he had meant to the country at the time. So, you know, certainly a lot of opportunities for him to sort of say thank you, you know, to the people of in this area and communities and things that had been so supportive of him and his presidency.
Originally a 10-room hotel called Alexander House, Lakeside Inn was built in 1883 by James Alexander, John McDonald, and John Donnelly. In 1893, Emma Boone bought the property and renamed it Lake House, settling on the name Lakeside Inn in 1903. In 1924, during the presidency of Calvin Coolidge, the Edgerton family bought Lakeside Inn and operated the property for more than 50 years. In 1930, Lakeside Inn was managed by Albert Hurlburt, a personal friend of Calvin Coolidge.
Captain Hurlburt was the assistant to Calvin Coolidge when he was the governor of Massachusetts, and they became very good friends. In fact, when Hurlburt died in the early 1950s, Coolidge's wife, Grace, said, this was his closest, most dear friend. She said, he told him stuff he never told me. So they were very close friends. Also, Hurlburt drove him from St. Petersburg here. So, and I think he had set up a lot of the events, certainly the dedications that took place here. He was orchestrating a lot of that.
The inn at that time had just gone through a pretty significant expansion period. The addition of the terrace building was sort of the last phase of that at the time. But the ownership of the inn had as happens in old places like this, had changed, and so through that 20s period, that mid-20s period, there was a bunch of new building and whatnot, and the terrace building was the last piece of that, and it just sort of happened that the timing sort of coordinated when the Coolidges were here, and he was asked if he would, and he said sure, and that's how it all came to be. But it wasn't that he came here specifically to dedicate, the opening of that particular building. But it was, I think it was probably very gracious of them to participate.
Grace Coolidge is a remarkable first lady, and I'm not sure she is given the credit that she should be given. But she was a teacher, and she taught in a school for the deaf. And they, I think one of their philanthropic projects after they left office and during office even was the Clark School for the Deaf. But she wrote lyrics for music. They have a framed picture here in the hotel of one of the poems she wrote. Very artistic-minded individual. And I think humorous and charming in her approach with people.
The hotel was quite social, as hotels were back in those days, So, people would gather and, it's a big lobby. People would gather in the lobby before going in for dinner. After dinner, Grace would play the piano, and they'd have sing-alongs and things of that sort. She was quite, and engaging with everybody. So it wasn't as if they were standoffish or they just went straight from their room and back to the, to dinner and back and forth and that sort of thing.
Dylan Gomez is also with Mount Dora's Lakeside Inn.
Silent Cal, as he was known, he kept a bit more to himself, and guests were asked, and in that time it was probably much easier to do, to just keep their distance a little bit. Not that he wasn't friendly, but he had, as we said, just gotten out of the presidency and needed some time to decompress. So they were active. I would say Grace was definitely more social. She was known to play the piano in the lobby and host sing-alongs with the guests. So she was very charismatic and very engaging. And they obviously made friends throughout town and attended a lot of events. Grace did a planting of a tree, a ceremonial tree, over at the community center.
During their month-long stay in Mount Dora, Calvin Coolidge got his hair cut by the barber in town, and he and Grace attended a local church. Among their many day trips was a visit to Florida's most popular tourist attraction at the time, Silver Springs.
Once they were out of office, they came here to Lakeside Inn, but they did a whole bunch of traveling throughout the state. And I think it was just kind of a way to remove themselves from being in office for so long and do some sightseeing and get to the warmth, because it was January and February after all. So it was the perfect time to come and explore Florida.
In addition to visiting tourist attractions like Silver Springs, the Coolidges attended events, including the Orange Festival in Winter Haven. Hamilton Holt, the president of Rollins College in Winter Park, had invited Coolidge to visit the campus several times. In 1930, Coolidge accepted Holt's invitation. While maintaining an active schedule in Florida, Coolidge also took some time to relax and reflect at Lakeside Inn. Madonna Jarvis Wise, and Dylan Gomez.
Well, he had some losses in his life that were pretty significant. And I think he lost his mother when he was 12 years old. And then a few years later, he lost his sister from an acute case of appendicitis. But I think the most significant loss was the loss of his son, from a blister he acquired at the White House. He loved playing tennis every day with his older brother. And in an age before penicillin, he died of blood poisoning. Many people say that changed him.
We are currently in the room that Calvin Coolidge and his wife Grace stayed in for just about a month after his presidency. And this room here overlooks the lake. It's a beautiful spot. There's an area where there was a desk. And while it's not the original now, we do have one there because you can just imagine Calvin sitting there writing his letters, thinking about his time in office, and just really enjoying this little cozy spot right by Lake Dora. So today we do have a copy of his original registration card displayed outside, and we have plaques honoring both of them in their stay here, as well as a couple of portraits of him.
For much more about Calvin Coolidge in Florida, watch the latest episode of Florida Frontiers Television on your local PBS affiliate, or find it anytime at myfloridahistory.org.
We cannot observe this movement without smiling a little at those who but a short time ago expressed so much fear lest our country might come under the control of a few individuals of great wealth. They claimed that the rich were growing richer and the poor were growing poorer. Our experience has demonstrated that the reverse of this would be much nearer the truth.
This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org to find out about the Florida Historical Society Public History Forum, May 28th through 30th at the Shores Resort and Spa in Daytona. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, as the 17th century dawned, St. Augustine was the only European settlement in North America. During the next 100 years, multiple events threatened the existence of what we know as the oldest town in America.
In her evaluation of St. Augustine, Susan Parker cast doubt on the viability of this settlement. Quote, even at the young age of 35, St. Augustine had endured longer than many European settlements in North America. But she wondered if there was any sense of permanence to the town. In her 2014 article, St. Augustine in the 17th Century Capital of La Florida, Parker argues that although the settlement experienced multiple disasters throughout the century, its permanence was secured by the early 18th century as the value of the site was made apparent as the result of the shifting political dynamics of the Atlantic world. From its origins in 1565, St. Augustine faced extraordinary challenges, including hostilities with indigenous people that forced a temporary relocation of the settlement, a raid by the English privateer Francis Drake, a fire in 1599 that destroyed the south end of town and the Franciscan monastery, and a devastating hurricane that occurred in September of the same year that destroyed the island that sheltered the port and caused the collapse of the wooden fort that protected the settlers. The repeated disasters caused the Spanish government to question the wisdom of continuing to support the military presence and the future of the settlement. In 1602, Fernando Valdez arrived in St. Augustine to conduct an inquiry into the viability of the town. For more than 2 weeks, he collected testimony from residents about the land, the coast, and the surrounding indigenous people. 5 years later, King Philip III ordered the dismantlement of the fort and the relocation of the Christianized Indian population to Hispaniola. The order was never implemented because the English settlement of Jamestown in Virginia changed colonial dynamics and secured St. Augustine's importance to the Spanish Empire. In 1608, the order was rescinded, and Spain committed to continued financial support for the settlement. In addition to its strategic importance for Spanish ships sailing the Gulf Stream on the voyage to Spain, Franciscan friars had convinced the king that the thousands of indigenous converts to Christianity could not be abandoned. As Parker explains, quote, for the next 70 years, much of the European energies in Florida would focus on the hinterland and to converting the natives to Christianity, including inculcating them with European values and incorporating them into La Florida's Spanish society. Indians in missions grew corn to help sustain the presidio, provided labor for defense works, worked as personal servants, and at times served as defenders of the Spanish presence outside St. Augustine, end quote.
Connie, achieving ongoing financial support from the Spanish government provided St. Augustine with some breathing room, but it didn't solve all the community's difficulties, right?
No, it didn't. In the first place, the payments were not made regularly. But perhaps more importantly, the settlement continued to face substantial challenges, including population decline, multiple outbreaks of epidemic diseases, and attacks by pirates. In 1600, St. Augustine's population was a polyglot mix of Spanish-descendant Creoles, Africans, many of whom were enslaved, indigenous people, and shipwrecked survivors from a variety of European nations. As John Bartram would later describe St. Augustine, quote, the inhabitants were of all colors, whites, Negroes, mulattoes, Indians, etc., end quote. And yet the spotty record shows a consistent decline in population, in part due to the repeated epidemics that, quote, dominated the first half of the 17th century, end quote. Anthropologist John Wirth described the 17th century mission era as, quote, a free fall decline, end quote, in the indigenous population that puzzled the Spanish governors who believed the Christianized natives were well treated. The epidemics that devastated the missions also made their way to streets of St. Augustine, usually with fewer deaths. But in the mid-century, the settlement was hit with two outbreaks of yellow fever and one outbreak of smallpox that followed one another in quick succession. The series of deadly outbreaks claimed the lives of the governor, the treasurer, two company captains, and several friars. As Parker notes, quote, one scourge replaced another, end quote. The epidemics declined in number and mortality after mid-century, but piracy rose in frequency and impact. Sailing from Jamaica, which had become a pirate base, Robert Searles, alias Robert Davis, attacked St. Augustine on May 29, 1668, pillaging the settlement for gold and silver religious items, killing 60 residents and kidnapping 70 men, women, and children. The governor paid a ransom of food, water, and wood for the release of the captives, but the pirates retained the non-white members of the group to sell as slaves. The loss through death and kidnapping of so many residents was an almost insurmountable blow to the community. Recognizing the vulnerability of St. Augustine, the Spanish crown provided money to construct Castillo de San Marcos, which began construction on October 2, 1672, just as the settlement faced a new threat in the form of the English colony of South Carolina, which was established in 1670. Almost immediately, white indentured servants, and then enslaved blacks, saw St. Augustine as a sanctuary for escape from the plantations that soon dotted the area around Charlestown. Once in St. Augustine, some escapees sailed out as crew members on ships docked at the port, while others remained, quote, to add their skills, energies, and personal histories to the city, end quote. Abetted by the English in Charlestown, piracy resumed in the 1880s. Fed up with repeated raids, attacks against the English were launched from St. Augustine in 1686. Setting fire to Stewartstown on what is now Paris Island and plundering the plantations on Edesto Island, including the plantation of the English governor, Joseph Morton, the Spanish fleet was caught in a hurricane and the flagship was lost. After the Spanish raid, the English raids on St. Augustine ceased, and English settlement south of Charlestown was forbidden for at least 15 years.
Well, the St. Augustine population must have drawn a collective sigh of relief.
As always, yes and no. To assure the security of Spanish Florida, the Crown began reinforcing the military presence by dismissing Creole soldiers and replacing them with soldiers from Spain. The shift deprived the Creoles of wages they had counted on and affected marriages and families. Women preferred to marry the Iberian soldiers who had an income, and women who had property in the land were the preferred marriage partners of the soldiers. Over time, an important shift in wealth occurred to the advantage of the Spanish. Creole families who owned stores or shops that provided necessary services also benefited from the wages soldiers earned. As Parker notes, these new men and new money meant a prosperity St. Augustine had not previously known. Evidence of that prosperity can be seen in the construction of more substantial housing, including a new Coquino house for the governor. By 1700, St. Augustine residents had reason to hope. The decades of epidemics and pirate raids were behind them. They were protected by an enduring fortress. The town had expanded geographically and boasted a more influential population living in masonry houses. They enjoyed a sense of stability that had eluded them since 1565.
And of course, St. Augustine is alive and well today. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Orville and Wilbur Wright flew the first airplane in 1903 for a 12-second flight in North Carolina. As Sebastian Garcia reports, flying soon came to Florida.
Matthew Ferguson is a graduate history student at the University of Central Florida. He recently delivered a presentation titled The Early Flights, Florida's Aviation History, 1910 to 1926. 7 years after the Wright brothers flew the world's first successful airplane, aviation arrived in Florida, with the Orange County Fair hosting a 1910 competition to see who could stay in the air the longest.
The Orange County Fair in 1910 held a flight competition where the goal was to stay in the air as long as you can. The competition was using powered flight, so early biplanes with water-cooled engines, and funnily enough, the competition only lasted about 5 minutes. The winner was a pilot named Lincoln Beachy, who was using a Curtiss biplane that was named after Glenn Curtiss, another very famous aviator from Florida's history, who later established his own flying school, and also was a rival of the Wright brothers. The Wright brothers had already established the practice 7 years earlier, so it was largely a private practice. As well, you had to own or be able to make your own aircraft in order to participate, but public interest was nonetheless still very high, especially with the Orange County Fair. A lot of money was put aside for the prize for the flying competition to attract aviators coming in. The prize wound up being about $1,500, which in 1910 was a significant amount of money.
2 years later, in 1912, Glenn Curtiss established Florida's first flight school in Miami.
The Glenn Curtiss Flight School, this was an attempt by the city of Miami, according to what records I found. It was an attempt to better secure their spot within the world of aviation, to highlight the possibilities with the practice and attract more people who were interested to come gain the skills. Over the next several decades, a lot of aviators were trained there, including Lincoln Beachy, who, as mentioned earlier, he won the Orange County Fair competition in 1910. But even beyond that, the city took some more initiative, doing some flying exhibitions in 1911 and 1912, in which they were simply showing off the practice and garnering more public support for it.
In 1914, aviation in Florida became commercial when two brothers, Tony and Roger Janis, established the first commercial flight line between St. Petersburg and Tampa.
The first commercial flight in St. Petersburg and Tampa was an airboat line. It was established by two brothers, Tony and Roger Janis. They used an aircraft. It was called a Benoit Model 14. That could take one passenger and a few carry-ons across the water between the two cities in about 22 minutes. It was the first commercial experiment with flight in Florida. It was successful. It was fairly popular. However, due to limitations with the aircraft itself, they can only make the trip about 2 to 3 times per day, and their contract with the cities was over in about 3 to 4 months. And according to what records I was able to find for this project, it's a little unclear whether their contract was ever renewed.
Florida's environmental conditions attracted many of these early aviators, including the military, who sought to train pilots in the wake of the First World War.
Florida, according to my research, presented a very unique opportunity for flight schools. Reviewing climate records from that time period show how even the environmental conditions then matched the standards for modern flight. So this made the state very attractive for a lot of flight schools, especially for military pilots during World War I, which is the first war where an air element started becoming much more prevalent. We didn't have an Air Force yet. It was mainly the Army Air Corps. A lot of military pilots started training in Florida because of that good climate. The first school was established as the U.S. Naval Air Station in Pensacola in 1914, and another was established near Arcadia, Florida in 1917. That was called Carlstrom Field.
Several World War I veteran pilots founded Florida Airways in 1926, one of the first interstate commercial flight services.
Florida Airways, that was one of the first early commercial services available in the state regarding flight. It was founded in 1926 by several World War I veteran pilots, including Eddie Rickenbacker, one of the most decorated pilots from that conflict. Now, this was one of the first expansive commercial networks. While the St. Petersburg-Tampa Airboat Line was the first example of commercial flight, it only lasted for a limited time. Florida Airways lasted for several years and connected cities all across the state: Miami, Fort Myers, Tampa, and Jacksonville. The planes, manufactured by Ford Motor Company, they could carry up to 8 passengers and assorted packages, so they acted both as transport and delivery. They took them between those 4 cities, and it was honestly a lot faster than driving a car. It slowly became a more popular practice, but even then, we didn't have the types of airports that we see today.
Matthew bookends Florida's early aviation history through 1926, as, by 1927, the first international flight took place, ushering a new era in Florida aviation.
I stopped right before the first international flight took place, which was Pan American in 1927. So I decided to first show how the commercial flights began. Especially for the state of Florida, there were other international flights before that. There was another called, I believe, Aeromarine. That one was much earlier than even Florida Airways.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida, Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Until then, visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org, where you can register for the 2026 Florida Historical Society Public History Forum, taking place May 28th through 30th in Daytona Beach. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.